I don't know your last. What is your last name? What is your last name?
Okay. All right. Then I'll find your name.
Okay. Oh yeah.
Thank you, everyone. Hello, and first, apropos of love, Shoshana Bloom asked me to announce a bit of an unusual announcement that this would have been the 49th wedding anniversary of her husband, who unfortunately was a nifter, Tzvi Ben Yosef, Zichrono Livracha, and although it is not a yahrzeit, but certainly a time of memory and connection, and the Limud HaTorah in someone's merits is always something that elevates the neshama, so we hope that your love for him will continue to elevate his neshama in a very good way. I want to begin with a story that many people, it's just a little story, it's not a major story, but when many people hear it, they're quite shocked, and they don't understand it. But it actually carries a message that is relevant to my topic. They tell the story about a very righteous Rebbetzin in the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim in the 19th century, and they lived in abject poverty. And every once in a while, they got one egg, and one day she got one egg for breakfast, and she had 10 children. And there was a question, how do you divide one egg among 10 children? So the story goes, she went into the bedroom and she ate it herself.
Now, you think, hey, that doesn't sound so righteous to me. But this was your cheshbon. A cheshbon truly l'shem shemayim. I give every child 1/10 of an egg. What's it going to do? Nothing. I give myself the energy to be there for them, to love them, to take care of them. They're going to get a lot more from my eating the egg than giving them a tiny fraction of an egg. What is the message here? The message here is that self-love is not about ego and it's not about selfishness. It's exactly the opposite. For us to be able to give to others, for us to be able to help others, for us to take care of our spouses, of our children, of our talmidim, of our employees, whatever relationship we have, in order to be truly kind and generous and giving, a person must take care of themselves, and a person must respect themselves, and a person must be machshir themselves. Because if they are in nothing, then by definition they have nothing to give. If they are insignificant, then by definition there is nothing worthwhile they can accomplish. So in truth, Hillel said this all. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? And then, if I'm only for myself, ma'ani, what type of person am I? But you'll notice the sequencing is very mitzuyak. There has to be a sense of taking care of who you are, nurturing who you are, in the physical sense, in the spiritual sense, in the emotional sense. Because only when you are taking care of yourself and you're able to love and take care of others. And indeed, the Torah itself implies this in the Pasuk, V'yahavta l'rayecha kamocha, love your friend, love your neighbor. And Rabbi Shlomo used to say that refers particularly to husband and wife. You know, that's your best friend, but it refers to Am Yisrael. As you love yourself, if you hate yourself, what type of love are you going to give to somebody else? Implicit in the statement, love your neighbor as you love yourself, is you have to love yourself. So that's kind of what we're going to be talking about. I'm sure, obviously, there may be some overlap and repetition with the wonderful shiur that Rabbi Silver, I'm sure, gave you, knowing I didn't hear it, but I know him from Baltimore, so I can imagine he gave you a wonderful, wonderful shiur. But repetition is not the worst thing in the world either. As Rav Aaron Lapiansky says, when you get your buddy's kakash, you don't say, I had it last year. You take it again. And words of Torah we can hear again and again, because it takes a long time sometimes for Torah thoughts to penetrate our hearts. And sometimes hearing it, the same thought, but maybe a different way of saying it, a different perspective, different supporting text, can make the Roshan a little bit deeper and more permanent. So I really want to just show you from a different places in the Torah the idea of what it means to love yourself, to appreciate yourself. Because ultimately, you know, there's a saying on a t-shirt, and I'm a big chassid of sayings on t-shirts. I like cliches and I like t-shirts, because they almost always express universal truths. But I think cliches get a bad rap. I mean, cliches are cliches because they do express things that are true. And that is the old thing that teenagers wear, at least in the United States, God doesn't make junk. What does one say about a creator that he creates inferior merchandise? People who have nothing to offer, people who have nothing to give. You're not just being modest here. You're basically being blasphemous. You're basically saying the Creator wasted His infinite energy on creating things without purpose and without value. And therefore, when you validate yourself and you respect yourself, you're recognizing the power that you have to be a transforming power for goodness in the world. And therefore, you are giving glory to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. by that very act. So let me just share with you a few texts. The first, I want to start with yesterday's parsha. Yesterday's parsha, we read about the mysterious Parah Aduma, the red heifer, this red cow that is burnt and its ashes are mixed with spring water. And if anybody was ever tamei metz, come in contact with the dead, you could not enter the Beis HaMikdash, the Harabayas, unless you would be sprinkled with this, actually twice, on day 3 of your tumah and on day 7. That is the technical reason why none of us can go onto the Harabayas, because we are all tamei metz, and we need the sprinkling of the Parah Adumah. You may know that there is presently a Parah Aduma in an undisclosed location near Lakewood. It is actually owned by a devout Christian couple who are in consultation with the rabbis of Lakewood to be sure that they don't make it puzzle, huh? Yes, I'm not joking, yeah. Because there are a lot of things, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. If you work with the Parah, it is puzzle. And work is defined as, if I lean on it, it's already puzzle. If it mates with a bull, it is already puzzle. If it has a yoke, it is puzzle. So you got to be careful. You need the rabbi to instruct you exactly what to do and the like. Now we know the Parah Adumah is the epitome of what is called a chok. A chok are mitzvot, which undoubtedly have a deep, deep reason, because everything Hashem does will have a reason, but we really can't get it. It's something beyond our intellect. It is not a logical construct. But in particular, the thing that is most illogical about it is paradox and contradiction. Because on one hand, it is a vehicle for purity. I'm Tamei, and this purifies me. And yet, at the same time, all the people who prepare the parah, who shecht it and gather the ashes and transport it, they become tamei. By the way, just to clarify, this does not create an infinite regression. People say, oh, so they have to be sprinkled? No. The tumah of carrying or preparing the parah aduma does not in itself require sprinkling with the ashes. So you could break, all they do is go to the mikveh, but they are tamei. So this is the famous paradox of mitaher es atmeim. It purifies the impure. Umitamei es atahorim. It contaminates the pure. How can that be? Is it good or bad? How can the same thing bring purity and holiness and create tumah? What's going on? Well, this was such a puzzle that even Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all people, didn't have an answer to this. And he said, Amarti Echkama. I said to myself, I wanted to be wise, I'm going through the whole Torah, and I understand everything. When I get to this, Rechalka Mimeni, the wisdom is beyond me. And the Mepharshim say, since I didn't understand this one, that kind of shows me, even what I thought I understood, was only scratching the surface. So, in the spirit of where angels fear to tread, fools rush in, I will actually share with you an explanation of this paradox, but it is not my own explanation. It is indeed from a very, very great source, the Sfas Emes, who gives us a partial insight into this paradox that I think is relevant to our topic. Death came into the world because of the sin of Adam and Chava, in eating from the Eitz Hadas. Originally, mankind was supposed to be immortal. But death came into the world because Biyom Achalcham Mimenu, the day that you eat from that tree, from that fruit, most hamus, you will die, meaning you will be subject to death and disintegration. What was the Nachash's claim that enticed Adam and Chava, first Chava then Adam, to eat from the Eitz Hadas? So the Sfarim tell us it was the claim that when you eat this fruit, v'hayisem kelokim, you will be like God, yodei tov v'ra, understanding the nature, the true nature of good and evil. Now whatever that means, that is a massive talk for another time. But Rav Tzadok says, the essence of the hasasa, of the enticement, was the ego of being God. Imagine if I offered you a God pill. Take this pill, and you will be the Almighty. The ultimate ego trip. Death came into the world because of arrogance, hubris, ego. In many, many ways, man is indeed godlike. We are made in the image of God, and that does not mean the physical image of God. God has no physical image. But we have attributes of intelligence, free will, autonomy, creativity. Hashem gave us the power to create, although not Yeshmiyayin, to create and to destroy. And indeed, it is our moral obligation to utilize those powers. Emunah in Hashem is not quiescent or passive, as some Eastern religions might teach. It does not simply mean surrender to what it is. A religious Jew is supposed to drain the swamps and help bring the world to a higher state of justice and help the poor and alleviate misery. And we don't simply say, Hashem Yazor. Yes, Hashem is the source of all blessing in the world, but He requires that we be His partner. Even in the presence of Limud HaTorah, the dichotomy between the written Torah and the oral Torah suggests the importance of human initiative and creativity. So we are godlike, and it is proper that we exercise those aspects of divinity. But there is always the danger of arrogance, the danger of what the Torah itself calls Kochi v'yosim yodi asali yisachai alazeh. All of my great heroic efforts come from my might and my abilities. V'ram levalecha, the Torah goes on and says, actually it's the pasuk before that, your heart will become high and mighty. V'shachachta es Hashem Elokecha, you will forget God. So death came into the world as the ultimate reminder that as godly as we in fact are, as powerful as the abilities Hashem gave us in this world, there is an unbridgeable gap, a chasm, between Borei and Nivra, the Creator and the creation, of which death is the most visible reminder. But here is what the Sfas Emes says. If death comes into the world through arrogance, hubris, gaiva, we become liberated from the contamination of death by humility, submission, self-abnegation. Ashes. Again, we're not explaining why a red cow, but just ashes. Ashes is symbolic of a sense of nothingness, a sense of obliterating your gaiva. When Avraham Avinu pleads for Sodom and declares that he is unworthy, Avraham Avinu says, Anochi afar va'efer, I am dust in ashes. You know the Greek legend of the phoenix bird, which I say Greek legend because unfortunately that's more known. Chazal have a virtually identical metric. How out of the ashes comes new life. That is a profoundly deep thought. Because modesty, humility, when we obliterate our arrogance, our gaiva, we become liberated, we become reborn out of the ashes. Death comes into the world through arrogance. We become liberated from death by ashes. Humility, ego obliteration. In fact, even mikveh is the other purification ritual. A person needs parah aduma, ashes, and mikveh, and it's been said many times, mikveh, which is a ritual that is still followed today, obviously, connotes returning to the womb-like environment of killing off the old self and being reborn. This is the general idea of parah aduma. But now, physicists say there is matter and antimatter. There is a contradiction between Newtonian physics and quantum. Don't ask me to explain, I really cannot. But in the universe, there is inherent paradox. In the spiritual law, there is also paradox, not just in the halacha. I'm going to give you two propositions. One is humility, submission, self-annihilation is the most important thing, to remove ourselves from impurity and connecting to God. That's proposition number one. Proposition number two, humility can be the most destructive force that exists in the universe. How can they both be true? Because there is kosher humility, and then there's the humility that is really a parasite that sucks the life out of you, even though it has the appearance. It looks the same way as the other type on some level, but it's radically different. There is the humility of empowerment. When I transcend my ego and I recognize that all of the gifts that Hashem gave me are to be used for His service, to bring goodness into the world, to do mitzvahs, to do chesed, then I become empowered. Because you know, one of the things that happens when a person is filled with ego is, number one, there's no room for God because everything is about them. But number two, they become unable to act because often there is a fear of failure when my ego is my dominant motivator in life. There's often going to be a lot of things I'm not going to be willing to do because people might laugh at me, I may fail, I may not be successful. If a person has true humility and they understand that Hashem gave us talents to be used in good ways, then the only question we ask ourselves is, what is the right thing to do? And if it's the right thing, I'm going to do it. If I fail, if I flop, if people laugh at me, if I'm not successful, that's Hashem's achrayus. I do what I have to do. Right? A person might be embarrassed to go over to a stranger and greet them because maybe the stranger won't respond with friendship and you'll be embarrassed. But when we don't have the ego, and again, I'm not giving mushroom to anyone, I'm speaking to myself. If we don't have the ego, we go ahead and do what we need to do. So that humility is empowering. That humility lets me go ahead. It frees me. It liberates me. It purifies me. It connects me to Hashem. But when the humility takes a nasty left turn to convey the message to me, the internalized message, I'm worthless, I'm ineffectual, I don't have the ability to do good things, on some level that may sound like humbleness. In reality, it is what the Bali Musar call the firmest of the Yetzer Haras, because it comes in the guise of righteousness, so to speak. Although even there, the Mesilas Yesharim says, our psyches play tricks on us. Mesilas Yesharim talks about the person who is a Baal Gaiva because of his humility. So he makes a conspicuous point of always sitting in the back of the room, you know, so people will see, whatever, it's this kind of a notion of, I am so modest that, you know, I don't take any kavod. Sometimes a person should take kibudim, not to make a scene about how modest they are. You know, that's an issue. Okay. But putting that aside, even the genuine feeling, I am worthless, is a tremendous yitzhar. Because if we don't recognize our strengths, if we don't appreciate the gifts that Hashem gave us, we will never become the person that we were supposed to be. We will never accomplish our mission. We will go through our lives as an incomplete, I mean, all of us are going to be incomplete after 120, but at least to some degree, we were put into the world for a purpose. And thus, Rav Tzadok writes in Sitka Satsanik, his book of short reflections, just as a person is obligated to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a person is obligated to believe in themselves. If you don't believe in yourself, you will never accomplish your mission. So consequently, the Sfas Emes says quite brilliantly that this is a partial meaning of the paradox of Parah Aduma. The same external midah of humility and submission that can bring you to purity when it is coupled with an appreciation of who you are, that very same midah will contaminate you when it results in not appreciating who you are. Mithras, and there may not be externally such a difference, humble, humble, modest, modest, self-effacing, self-effacing. But one is the highest level of Kedusha, and one destroys and sucks out the vitality that can exist within a life. The Torah tells us Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble person who ever walked the face of the earth. Now, what does that mean? Did Moshe Rabbeinu, someone asked Moshe Rabbeinu a shiloh, did he say, oh, go ask a five-year-old, he's so much smarter than me. That would not have been a praiseworthy characteristic. That would have been delusional. That would have been psychologically sick. Rahman al-Islam. Rather, true humility means you understand who you are. That you understand that it all comes from Hashem, and Hashem has given us responsibilities. Dr. Rabbi Kiveger once said a very nice thought, and someone asked me where this is, and I don't remember. I may have seen it maybe 30 years ago. Rabbi Kiveger says, the true idea of humility is you don't think of yourself poorly, of course, and you don't think of yourself positively. You just don't think of yourself. Meaning to say, humility is what we call a task-oriented life rather than a personal referendum. Because there is a common denominator between people of low self-esteem and people who are arrogant. And the common denominator is everything that happens is a referendum about them. Look at the great thing that I did. Look at how I messed up. But it's always the I. The humble person who loves and cherishes the good that they do, and they love and cherish the good that other people do, because it brings glory to Hashem. So I glory in my accomplishments. I get nachas from what I've done. I don't put down what I've accomplished, and I recognize my strengths. But I can also recognize other people's accomplishments as well. You know, I remember when my son was in first grade. So he came home one day, just to show you how sometimes children have certain ideas, natural ideas, that we lose as we get older a little bit. And he was so excited because they were giving out awards that day. And one of his friends got an award, and he was so excited. Oh, Nachum got this award. And as the adult, I was thinking, you didn't get the award. Why are you so happy? You know? But he was as happy for his friend getting the award as he would be for himself. Like, not jealousy, not rivalry. But the concept was, something nice happens. If it happened to me, I would be happy. If it happened to him, I would be happy. Rabbi Kiveger says that's kind of the notion of another. So you get nachas. The Chazon Ish, in fact, says in Emunah Bitachon, very interesting idea. He says even chesed sometimes comes from our insecurities. We want to do good because we want to be Balei Chesed. And the Chazon Ish gave us a little thought experiment to kind of challenge us on this. Let's say you're a person who loves to have Orchem for Shabbos. And it comes Friday night, and you don't have any guests. You feel bad that you don't have the sechus of achnasas orchem. Finally, in shul, you or your husband or someone sees a man or a woman, whoever it is, who seems not to have a place to eat. So you're very happy. You go over to the person and say, "Ah, Reb Yitz, could we have the pleasure and the schus of having you as a guest?" And the person tells you, "Oh, thank you so much. Just 5 minutes ago, so-and-so approached me, and they're going to have me over." So the Chazon Ish says, are you going to be happy that moment, or a little unhappy? If your chesed is you want to be mative to another person, then you really don't care if it's you or somebody else. Baruch Hashem, you have a place to go. When there's ego, I don't get the chance to show that I'm a righteous person. Now, let me say, it is certainly better to do chesed even with that motive than not. Obviously, we're not saying not to do that. But this is the idea that things are tinged with egotism. So this is the lesson of Parah Adumah. The lesson of Parah Adumah is, that humility, freeing ourselves of the shackles of ego, is so important, but at the same time, we have to appreciate the gifts that Hashem gave us. We can't look at others and say what they have. You know, the old story is an old story that if everybody would see all the tzaras and the problems in the world, and they would be able to choose their pekala, choose their bag of tzaras, everybody would choose their own. they wouldn't choose, you know, we think everything is so wonderful on the other side. But one has to appreciate your kochas. You know, it's been said that Rav Yeruchim of Mir, one of the great, great, great Balei Musar, Rav Yeruchim was the Rebbe of Rav Shlomo Volba, Zichrono Livracha. In fact, just as an aside, Rav Volba remarked, when he came to Mir in the 1930s from Germany, so he met a kolo man in Mir, and the kolo man said to him, "How old do you think I am?" Rav Volba had no idea. He said, "Well, you look like you're 30. And the kolo man said, "No, I'm only 2 years old." "What do you mean? How can you be 2 years old?" He said, "I met Rav Yeruchim 2 years ago on this day. And that was the day that I was born." And Rav Volba then writes, he felt the same way. He says, after learning with Rav Yeruchim, he could say the same thing about himself. So Rav Yeruchim was a tremendous, tremendous Baal Hashpah on generations of people. And their disciples, their Talmidim. Rav Yeruchim once said, "A person who does not know their faults is a fool. You think you're perfect? That's delusional. But a person who does not know their greatness is a tragedy. He will never have the tools to become the person they were destined to be." And there is nothing more tragic than that. Putting aside reincarnation, in which perhaps we do get multiple chances, so to speak. Generally speaking, you know, we have one physical life. We hope it'll be 120 years. And our Olam Haba and our Nitzchias depends on what we do with the physical life that Hashem gave us. That is why even the Vilna Gaon, in his last minutes of life, was crying as he took his tzitzis. And he said, for just a few pennies, a few kopecks, one can get so much by this mitzvah. And in Olam Haba, you're kind of frozen. Although Baruch Hashem, the mitzvahs that our children and Talmidim do can elevate the neshama. But the meis cannot do mitzvahs anymore. That's why in front of a meis we don't wear tzitzis or tefillin or even learn Torah, because that's called lo ed l'rash. We're making fun of a person. We cannot do those things anymore. This is our life. This is our opportunity. But our abilities and our kochos are our toolbox. A plumber cannot prepare pipes without his tools. If we don't know what's in our toolbox, we don't appreciate what Hashem gave us, then we're not going to be able to do the job. And therefore, Rabbi Ruchim said that is a tragedy. It's not just foolishness, but it's the tragedy. By the same token, it is said at the Levaya of the Chazon Ish, Rav Dessler, you know, the Michta Melia, Rav Dessler came from England, originally Lithuania, then England, and then eventually he came to Eretz Israel. By the way, as a little aside, apropos of nothing, just a little interesting historical knowledge, Rav Dessler came out of Musar. He and Rav Yeruchim were both Talmidim in Kelim. And Kelim was not a Hasidic place. They didn't learn Sifrei Hasidus. But Rav Dessler, almost single-handedly, was the person who brought the study of Hasidic Sfarim into the mainstream yeshiva world. Rav Dessler made a major contribution. In the United States, that was done by Rav Huttner. So they're actually pivotal figures in what becomes the curriculum in the yeshiva world. And some of the alter Musarniks were not in favor of it at all. But be it as it may, at the Levaya of the Chazon Ish, I think it was either 1954 or 55, there was a bachur from Panovich who was crying, he was sobbing. And Rav Dessler went over to the bachur in the middle of the Chazon Ish's Levaya and said, "Why are you crying? over the Rav Gaon and Tzaddik, who's buried there, pointing to the kever of the Chazon Ish. He then pointed to the boy. You should cry over the Rav, the Gaon, and the Tzaddik that's buried here. Because the Chazon Ish became the person that he was supposed to become. How many of us don't? That comes because we don't recognize the greatness that we have and the goodness that we have. And we think we're therefore incapable. When in fact there's so much that we can do if we realistically look at ourselves in a positive light. You know, we say every morning, Moda ani, or the feminine would be Moda ani, if you want to be grammatically correct. And we say in the morning, when Hashem gives us our life back, you know what they say, some people don't want to get out of bed till they check the obituaries, and then they see it's okay, so they get out of bed. But literally, again, seriously, people can die in their sleep, God forbid. Every morning, there's a new gift of life, and we say, Shechazarta bi nishmasi b'chemla. Be sure you know where you put the period. You have returned my soul to me with graciousness and compassion. Rabba emunasecha. Your faith is great. Now the two words, Rabba emunasecha, are actually a pasuk. They're part of a pasuk in Megillas Eicha. We're going to read it on Tisha B'Av. Chadashim l'karim, as it's referring to returning life every morning. Chadashim l'karim, there is the renewal of the mornings. Rabba emunasecha, your faith is great. So the question that Mefarshim ask is, what is your faith? Faith, emuna, seems to be something we have in God. My faith in God is great. I believe in God. So it should say, Rabba emunasi. My faith in the Creator is great. Why? Rabba emunasecha? Now, grammatically, this is actually not a question, and the reason is that in biblical Hebrew, emunah does not refer to faith. Actually, that's not even the translation. Emunah refers to faithfulness and dependability. So indeed, emunah is used with respect to God. Kel emunah. That doesn't mean the God of faith. Kel emunah means the God that is reliable and steady and steadfast and dependable. So when we say Rabba Munasach, we mean your dependability, Hashem, is great. The idea of emunah, in fact, even the word ma'amin, if you actually parse it down to its grammatical structure, ma'amin doesn't mean to believe. Ma'amin means I ascribe to the Almighty the quality of faithfulness and dependability. Because ma'amin is what you are ascribing to Hashem. I am a ma'amin. But be it as it may, at least in conventional speech, though, we refer to emunah in terms of what I believe. So the question, again, as I say, grammatically it's not a question, but in Hasidic Pshatim you don't have to necessarily have a powerful question. But so the question is, based on the conventional understanding, it should say Rabba Emunasi. And the answer is, perhaps, Al Derech HaDrash, that it does not refer to my faith in God, it refers to God's faith in me. Mm. What does that mean? Every single morning, when Hashem gives you life, He's whispering in your ear, you can do it. You have something to accomplish. You're worthwhile. You still have a job to do. Because if you didn't, you wouldn't wake up. If the job was finished, which would be actually a great bracha, or conversely, if you had no chance of accomplishing something significant, you wouldn't be given life. So every single morning, you're getting a vote from the Ribono Shel Olam. that you have something good that you can do today. So, if I feel insulted, I feel hurt, I feel low because of what people say to me or not being appreciated. But Hashem disagreed with all of that. He must have disagreed because he gave you life that day. A vote of confidence from the Creator. I mean, you know, people say, oh, if only God would tell me I'm doing okay. But he did, and he does. Because you woke up this morning. That's Rabba. Hashem has faith in us. Would we lose faith in ourselves? And sometimes we live in worlds where we don't always get the affirmation from others that a person might need. It happens. A person might be alone. A person might have difficulties, sometimes even with parents, with spouse, with children. And the person feels very alone. And the person questions their worth and questions their potential for good. But remember, not that this is going to be easy, because again, if we have to cut through a lot of thickets and a lot of brush, it's not going to be easy. I'm not suggesting any kind of feel-good, easy, quick path to achieve all of this. But the one thing that you have to know is you can do it. Because if Hashem gave you life, he said you're able to do something good. And that is the notion of Rabba and Munasecha. Hashem's faith in us is very, very great, even when we lose faith in ourselves. It's an important message. You know, it's been even said that some of the Sifrei Musar spend a lot of time talking about our chesronos, you know, all of the flaws, all of the faults. But I've been told by, and I've heard by great Gedolim, that sometimes we actually discourage people from focusing on those svarim, because we live in a weak generation. And a weak generation, we're not always ready to confront all of the negativities, although eventually we do have to. Rather, in the same way darkness is dispelled, not by taking a baseball bat and hitting the darkness, but darkness is dispelled by generating light. So too in our Avodas Hashem, we for ourselves, and I would also say for our children as well, need to concentrate on building up the light. And then the darkness kind of goes away by itself, because there is light. And when there is light, there will be no darkness. It's a modality of chinuch, it's a modality of relationship. As I say, there were different mahalchim. The musar of introspection is indeed a very, very important thing to do. But one cannot do it unless they're strong, unless they realize there's something good under all of the incrustations of dirt that we might have. People say in the, at least some people say in the Kira of Rechokin business, I hate calling it a business, but okay, I'm just throwing out a phrase. Unfortunately, it sometimes becomes that, but it isn't that at all. But they say, no person can change for the better unless they think they're okay the way they are. Right? If a person is truly worthless or feels they're worthless, they're never going to have the energy to move on. They think there's nothing they can do. So self-love, not, of course, in a narcissistic way, obviously, but self-love is the prerequisite for self-transformation and the condition for spiritual transformation. Because unless you think there's something there, there's nothing that that's going to become. So these are, again, things to think about. Let me bring out again, as I say, these are kind of unrelated points, but they're points that will connect in some ways. And that is, we're now in the fourth book of the Chumash. And the fourth book of the Chumash is, of course, the book of Bamidbar. Now the English name, which is actually corresponds to the rabbinic name of the Sefer, is the Book of Numbers. And indeed, Chazal call it Chomesh HaPikudim, the Chomesh of Census. I think the plural will be Sensai. And why is it called the Book of Numbers? Because the Jews are counted twice. In Parshas Bamidbar, it is the census of the Jews who left Egypt. And at the end of Parshas Pinchas, there is a census of the new generation that will be entering the land of Israel because the old generation died. Now it's interesting, the two totals are the same in both, but if you study it, you will see that some tribes lost a lot of people, some tribes gained a lot of people. That itself is a very interesting limit. There is fascination in those numbers and looking at who gained, who lost, and Chazal speak about why that is so. But the first census occurred 1 month after Hakamat HaMishkan. The Mishkan was set up Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and Rosh Chodesh Iyar, the Jewish people are counted. Rashi raises an interesting question. Rashi points out there actually is an unrecorded census that occurred in the aftermath of the golden calf, when the Jewish people were commanded to give a half shekel. And from the computation of the half shekel, Moshe counted the population. So the question that arises is, why is it necessary to count the population within a span of less than 6 months? Because the Cheder Egel occurred on the 17th of Tammuz. Indeed, next Sunday will be the anniversary of the Cheder Egel, Shivas Arba Tammuz. And Moshe Rabbeinu prayed and forgiveness was given on Yom Kippur, which is in Tishrei. And shortly after Yom Kippur, we don't have the exact date, they were counted by giving the half shekel. So between Tishrei and Iyar is only 6.5 months. So why is there a need to count them within the span of 6.5 months? Understand the question. Moreover, it's very interesting that the census after the Cheder Egel is only an aggregate census. We know how many Jews there were, but we don't know how many tribes. Reuven, Shimon, Levi. In Bamidbar, we have a tribal breakdown. Meaning to say, there are two differences between the census after Yom Kippur and the census 6.5 months later. Difference number one, census after Yom Kippur is just a total census. It is not a tribal breakdown. Census in Iyar is a tribal breakdown. That's difference number one. Difference number two, census in after the Cheder Egel was an anonymous census by people dropping shkolim in a pushka, and Moshe just counts the shekels. In Bamidbar, it is described as mispar shemot, which the Ramban interprets that even though people gave a half shekel there too, because you're not supposed to count people directly, but every person introduced himself to Moshe, so Moshe would know your name. You know, you would actually give your name. So what does all this suggest? Well, I would suggest the following, and again, this idea is talked about in different svarim, that counting comprises the creation of a community. But there are two different ways communities can be constructed. There is what you might call a melting pot ideal, and there is what you might call a salad bowl ideal. In a melting pot ideal, people of different backgrounds, different cultures come together, but they obliterate their uniqueness and their individuality towards a common end. Think about how Cholent looks on Wednesday is kind of a glop of stuff. You can no longer tell what is the meat, what is the potatoes, what is the barley. It just looks like one thing. That was, for many years, the model in the United States, in which, you know, now there's multiculturalism, which is the opposite extreme, but it used to be in the olden days, there was no concept of some other language in the public schools. You know, you learn English and that's it. And that's the notion of a melting pot. Melting pot is a community that is based on obliteration of difference. But there is another version of community that understands that a community must have common goals and common strivings. But the greatness of a community's goals is realized only when everybody's individual talents and creativity is appreciated and celebrated. So in a salad, the beauty of the salad would be the different colors, the different textures, the different tastes. You can use many metaphors for this. You can talk about a salad, you can talk about a tapestry, you can talk about a symphony, you can talk about a mosaic. But the concept is, the beauty inheres not in the repetitive sameness. The beauty inheres in a celebration of the differences. That is the difference between the first census and the second census. The first census was in the aftermath of a calamity and an emergency. In the aftermath of a tragedy in which God actually wants to wipe out the Jewish people, there is no time to march to the beat of your own drum. You got to come together like after the Holocaust. It wasn't time to talk about differences and uniqueness. We had to rebuild Am Yisrael. So as a temporary measure, you put aside your differences. But the permanent notion of community in Am Yisrael is not a community that obliterates the differences, but that celebrates. And thus, this is why tribes are so important. Because you might wonder, why are tribes important? What's the difference if I'm a Reuven or a Shimon? Why does every tribe have its flag? Every tribe has its place. Every tribe has its portion in the land of Israel. Doesn't that create divisiveness? Doesn't that create machlokas? Is it important that I'm Reuven and you're Shimon? We're Jews! The answer is, it is important. Because although Am Yisrael has a common mission, but we accomplish our mission by the different abilities and talents that Hashem has given us. And if that's true for the tribes, by extension, it's true for every individual. That ultimate redemption comes not by self-annihilation, but by taking the uniqueness within us and running with it. This is a difficult challenge, because indeed, if you stress individuality too much, you have anarchy, you don't have a community. And moreover, certain expressions of individuality are outside the misgaret of Torah and mitzvahs. But within the misgaret, one has to appreciate their uniqueness. And again, I know, you know, many of my students are people from backgrounds that are not religious. And what goes through a person's mind often is, if only I would also come from 10 generations of rabbis and scholars. Although, by the way, that doesn't guarantee anything. Karl Marx, I think, came from 35 generations of rabbis. So there's no guarantee no matter what you do. But if only I would be raised in Yerushalayim going back so many generations, there is so much I would have. But what can I do? I'm from North Dakota. I didn't keep my first Shabbos till I was 35. I have a blue tablecloth instead of a white tablecloth, and I give vegetable soup instead of chicken soup, which may get their daughters in trouble. They may not get into some seminary. But you know, what you got to realize is, God decided where your neshama was to be born. God put you in a certain place. Now, you didn't make that decision. It's not even a question of bechira, because you didn't make that decision. And God decided He put you in a certain journey because that journey is what you needed for the perfection of your soul. And if it's true that you or me, we don't have all of the gifts that the 10th generation Yerushalmi has. And that's very, very true. They have many, many gifts that we'll never really have. But you know, it's also true that the person from North Dakota has many, many gifts that the 10th generation Yerushalmi doesn't have. Each person was given the circumstances of life that is ideal for their ticket and that journey. Now that doesn't mean we take advantage of it. Sometimes we, you know, stay in North Dakota and don't do what we're supposed to be doing. That's already bechira. But in terms of raw materials, we have nothing to be ashamed of with our lives. God gave us the parents that we needed. God gave us the environment that we needed. And that is the potential not to become somebody else's Eved Hashem, but to become the Eved Hashem that is our destiny. And we take the life that Hashem gave us, and we cherish it, and we celebrate it, and we honor it. Because the honor that we give to the life that Hashem gave us is the honor that we give to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'chvod Yodi Asma. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us the ability to appreciate who we are, and then we will appreciate the Borei Olam and become the person that we're supposed to be. Thank you. Have a good day.